Chapter 6. The Gentleman Dressed in Newspaper. It was after 3 o'clock when, weary and sick at heart, the husband and wife reached home. Several hours passed before Tuppence could sleep. She lay tossing from side to side, seeing always that flower-like face with the horror-stricken eyes. The dawn was coming in through the shutters when Tuppence finally dropped off to sleep. After the excitement, she slept heavily and dreamlessly. It was broad daylight when she awoke to find Tommy up and dressed, standing by the bedside, shaking her gently by the arm. "Wake up, old thing. Inspector Marriott and another man are here and want to see you."
"What time is it?"
"Just on 11. I'll get Alice to bring you your tea right away."
"Yes, do. Tell Inspector Marriott I'll be there in 10 minutes.
A quarter of an hour later, Tuppence came hurrying into the sitting room. Inspector Marriott, who was sitting looking very straight and solemn, rose to greet her.
"Good morning, Mrs. Beresford. This is Sir Arthur Merivale."
Tuppence shook hands with a tall, thin man with haggard eyes and greying hair.
"It's about this sad business last night," said Inspector Marriott. "I want Sir Arthur to hear from your own lips what you told me. The words the poor lady said before she died. Sir Arthur has been very hard to convince."
"I can't believe," said the other, "and I won't believe that Bingo Hale ever hurt a hair of Vere's head."
Inspector Marriott went on.
"We've made some progress since last night, Mrs. Beresford," he said. "First of all, we managed to identify the lady as Lady Merivale. We communicated with Sir Arthur here. He recognised the body at once, and was horrified beyond words, of course. Then I asked him if he knew anyone called Bingo."
"You must understand, Mrs. Beresford," said Sir Arthur, "that Captain Hale, who is known to all his friends as Bingo, is the dearest pal I have. He practically lives with us. He was staying at my house when they arrested him this morning. I cannot but believe that you have made a mistake. It was not his name that my wife uttered."
"There is no possibility of mistake," said Tuppence gently. "She said, Bingo did it."
"You see, Sir Arthur," said Marriott.
The unhappy man sank into a chair and covered his face with his hands.
"It's incredible. What earthly motive could there be? Oh, I know your idea, Inspector Marriott. You think Hale was my wife's lover. But even if that was so, which I don't admit for a moment, what motive was there for killing her?"
Inspector Marriott coughed.
"It's not a very pleasant thing to say, sir, but Captain Hale has been paying a lot of attention to a certain young American lady of late. A young lady with a considerable amount of money. If Lady Merivale liked to turn nasty, she could probably stop his marriage."
"This is outrageous, Inspector."
Sir Arthur sprang angrily to his feet. The other calmed him with a soothing gesture.
"I beg your pardon, I'm sure, Sir Arthur. You say that you and Captain Hale both decided to attend this show. Your wife was away on a visit at the time, and you had no idea that she was to be there."
"Not the least idea."
"Just show him that advertisement you told me about, Mrs. Beresford,"
Tuppence complied.
"That seems to me clear enough. It was inserted by Captain Hale to catch your wife's eye. They had already arranged to meet there. But you only made up your mind to go the day before, hence it was necessary to warn her. That is the explanation of the phrase, necessary to finesse the king. You ordered your costume from a theatrical firm at the last minute, but Captain Hale's was a homemade affair. He went as the gentleman dressed in newspaper. And do you know, Sir Arthur, what we found clasped in the dead lady's hand? A fragment torn from a newspaper. My men have orders to take Captain Hale's costume away with them from your house. I shall find it at the yard when I get back. If there's a tear in it corresponding to the missing piece, well, it'll be the end of the case."
"He won't find it," said Sir Arthur.
"I know Bingo Hale."
Apologizing to Tuppence for disturbing her, they took their leave. Late that evening, there was a ring at the bell, and somewhat to the astonishment of the young pair, Inspector Marriott once more walked in.
"I thought Blunt's brilliant detectives would like to hear the latest developments,"
he said with a hint of a smile. Well, they would, said Tommy. Have a drink? He placed materials hospitably at Inspector Marriott's elbow. It's a clear case, said the latter, after a minute or two. Dagger was the lady's own. The idea was to have made it look like suicide, evidently. But thanks to you two being on the spot, that didn't come off. We found plenty of letters. They'd been carrying on together for some time, that's clear, without Sir Arthur tumbling to it. Then we found the last link.
The last what? Said Tuppence sharply.
The last link in the chain. That fragment of the Daily Leader. It was torn from the dress he wore. Fits exactly. Oh, yes. It's a perfectly clear case. By the way, I brought round a photograph of those two exhibits. I thought they might interest you. It's very seldom that you get such a perfectly clear case.
Tommy, said Tuppence, when her husband had returned from showing the Scotland Yard man out, why do you think Inspector Marriott keeps repeating that it's a perfectly clear case?
I don't know. Smug satisfaction, I suppose.
Not a bit of it. He's trying to get us irritated. You know, Tommy, butchers, for instance, know something about meat, don't they?
Well, I should say so, but what on earth?
And in the same way, greengrocers know all about vegetables, and fishermen about fish. Detectives, professional detectives, must know all about criminals. They know the real thing when they see it, and they know when it isn't the real thing. Marriott's expert knowledge tells him that Captain Hale isn't a criminal, but all the facts are dead against him. As a last resource, Marriott is egging us on, hoping against hope that some little detail or other will come back to us, something that happened last night which will throw a different light on things. Tommy, why shouldn't it be suicide after all?
Well, remember what she said to you.
I know, but take that a different way. It was Bingo's doing. His conduct that drove her to kill herself. It's just possible.
Just, but it doesn't explain that fragment of newspaper.
Let's have a look at Marriott's photographs. I forgot to ask him what Hale's account of the matter was.
Well, I asked him that in the hall just now. Hale declared he had never spoken to Lady Merivale at the show. Says somebody shoved a note in his hand which said, "Don't try and speak to me tonight. Arthur suspects." He couldn't produce the piece of paper, though, and it doesn't sound a very likely story.
Anyway, you and I know he was with her at the Ace of Spades because we saw him.
Tuppence nodded and pored over the two photographs. One was a tiny fragment with the legend Daily Lee, and the rest torn off. The other was the front sheet of the Daily Leader with the small round tear at the top of it. There was no doubt about it. Those two fitted together perfectly.
What are all those marks down the side? Asked Tommy.
Stitches, said Tuppence, where it was sewn to the others, you know.
I thought it might be a new scheme of dots, said Tommy.
Then he gave a slight shiver. My word, Tuppence, how creepy it makes one feel. To think that you and I were discussing dots and puzzling over that advertisement, all as light-hearted as anything.
Tuppence did not answer. Tommy looked at her, and was startled to observe that she was staring ahead of her mouth slightly open, and a bewildered expression on her face.
Tuppence, said Tommy gently, shaking her by the arm, what's the matter with you? Are you just going to have a stroke or something?
But Tuppence remained motionless. Presently she said in a faraway voice,
Dennis Reardon.
Eh? Said Tommy, staring.
It's just as you said. One simple, innocent remark. Find me all this week's Daily Leaders.
What are you up to?
I'm being McCarty. I've been worrying round, and thanks to you I've got a notion at last. This is the front sheet of Tuesday's paper. I seem to remember that Tuesday's paper was the one with two dots in the L of leader. This has a dot in the D of daily, and one in the L, too. Get me the papers and let's make sure.
They compared them anxiously.
Tuppence had been quite right in her remembrance. You see, this fragment wasn't torn from Tuesday's paper.
But Tuppence, we can't be sure. It may merely be different editions.
It may, but at any rate it's given me an idea. It can't be coincidence, that's certain. There's only one thing it can be, if I'm right in my idea. Ring up Sir Arthur, Tommy. Ask him to come round here at once. Say I've got important news for him. Then get hold of Marriott. Scotland Yard will know his address if he's gone home.
Sir Arthur Merivale, very much intrigued by the summons, arrived at the flat in about half an hour's time. Tuppence came forward to greet him. "I must apologize for sending for you in such a peremptory fashion," she said, "but my husband and I have discovered something that we think you ought to know at once. Do sit down." Sir Arthur sat down, and Tuppence went on. "You are, I know, very anxious to clear your friend." Sir Arthur shook his head sadly.
"I was, but even I have had to give in to the overwhelming evidence.
What would you say if I told you that chance has placed in my hands a piece of evidence that will certainly clear him of all complicity?"
"I should be overjoyed to hear it, Mrs. Beresford."
"Supposing," continued Tuppence, "that I had come across a girl who was actually dancing with Captain Hale last night at 12 o'clock, the hour when he was supposed to be at the Ace of Spades."
"Marvellous!" cried Sir Arthur. "I knew there was some mistake. Poor Vere must have killed herself after all."
"Hardly that," said Tuppence. "You forget the other man."
"What other man?"
"The one my husband and I saw leave the booth. You see, Sir Arthur, there must have been a second man dressed in newspaper at the ball. By the way, what was your own costume?"
"Mine? I went as a 17th-century executioner."
"How very appropriate," said Tuppence softly.
"Appropriate, Mrs. Beresford? What do you mean by appropriate?"
"For the part you played. Shall I tell you my ideas on the subject, Sir Arthur? The newspaper dress is easily put on over that of an executioner. Previously, a little note has been slipped into Captain Hale's hand asking him not to speak to a certain lady. But the lady herself knows nothing of that note. She goes to the Ace of Spades at the appointed time and sees the figure she expects to see. They go into the booth. He takes her in his arms, I think, and kisses her. The kiss of a Judas. And as he kisses, he strikes with the dagger. She only utters one faint cry, and he covers that with a laugh. Presently he goes away, and to the last, horrified and bewildered, she believes her lover is the man who killed her. But she has torn a small fragment from the costume. The murderer notices that. He is a man who pays great attention to detail. To make the case absolutely clear against his victim, the fragment must be seen to have been torn from Captain Hale's costume. That would present great difficulties unless the two men happened to be living in the same house. Then, of course, the thing would be simplicity itself. He makes an exact duplicate of the tear in Captain Hale's costume. Then he burns his own and prepares to play the part of the loyal friend." Tuppence paused. "Well, Sir Arthur?" Sir Arthur rose and made her a bow.
"The rather vivid imagination of a charming lady who reads too much fiction."
"You think so?" said Tommy.
"And a husband who is guided by his wife," said Sir Arthur. "I do not fancy that you will find anybody to take the matter seriously."
He laughed out loud, and Tuppence stiffened in her chair. "I would swear to that laugh anywhere," she said. "I heard it last in the Ace of Spades. And you are under a little misapprehension about us both. Beresford is our real name, but we have another." She picked up a card from the table and handed it to him. Sir Arthur read it aloud.
"International Detective Agency."
He drew his breath sharply.
"So, that is what you really are. That was why Marriott brought me here this morning. It was a trap."
He strolled to the window.
"A fine view you have from here," he said. "Right over London."
"Inspector Marriott,"
cried Tommy sharply. In a flash, the inspector appeared from the communicating door in the opposite wall. A little smile of amusement came to Sir Arthur's lips.
"I thought as much," he said. "But you won't get me this time, I'm afraid, Inspector. I prefer to take my own way out."
And putting his hands on the sill, he vaulted clean through the window. Tuppence shrieked and clapped her hands to her ears to shut out the sound she had already imagined, the sickening thud far beneath. Inspector Marriott uttered an oath.
"We should have thought of the window," he said.
"Though, mind you, it would have been a difficult thing to prove. I'll go down and see to things."
"Poor devil," said Tommy slowly.
"If he was fond of his wife,
But the inspector interrupted him with a snort.
Fond of her?
That's as may be. He was at his wit's end where to turn for money. Lady Merivale had a large fortune of her own, and it all went to him. If she'd bolted with young Hale, he'd never have seen a penny of it. Oh, that was it, was it? Of course, from the very start, I sensed that Sir Arthur was a bad lot, and that Captain Hale was all right. We know pretty well what's what at the Yard, but it's awkward when you're up against facts. I'll be going down now. I should give your wife a glass of brandy if I were you, Mr. Beresford. It's been upsetting-like for a...
Greengrocers,
said Tuppence in a low voice as the door closed behind the imperturbable inspector.
Butchers? Fishermen? Detectives?
I was right, wasn't I? He knew. Tommy, who had been busy at the sideboard, approached her with a large glass. Drink this.
What is it? Brandy?
No. It's a large cocktail, suitable for a triumphant McCarty. Yes, Marriott's right all round. That was the way of it. A bold finesse for game and rubber. Tuppence nodded.
But he finessed the wrong way round.
And so, said Tommy, exit the king. Chapter 7 The Case of the Missing Lady. The buzzer on Mr. Blunt's desk, International Detective Agency Manager Theodore Blunt, uttered its warning call. Tommy and Tuppence both flew to their respective peepholes, which commanded a view of the outer office. There it was Albert's business to delay the prospective client with various artistic devices. "I will see, sir," he was saying, "but I'm afraid Mr. Blunt is very busy just at present. He is engaged with Scotland Yard on the phone just now."
"I'll wait," said the visitor. "I haven't got the card with me, but my name is Gabriel Stevanson."
The client was a magnificent specimen of manhood, standing over 6 foot high. His face was bronzed and weather-beaten, and the extraordinary blue of his eyes made an almost startling contrast to the brown skin. Tommy swiftly made up his mind. He put on his hat, picked up some gloves, and opened the door. He paused on the threshold.
"This gentleman is waiting to see you, Mr. Blunt," said Albert.
A quick frown passed over Tommy's face. He took out his watch.
"I'm due at the Duke's at 11:15, he said. Then he looked keenly at the visitor. "I can give you a few minutes if you will come this way."
The latter followed him obediently into the inner office, where Tuppence was sitting demurely with pad and pencil.
"My confidential secretary, Miss Robinson," said Tommy. "Now, sir, perhaps you will state your business. Beyond the fact that it is urgent, that you came here in a taxi, and that you have lately been in the Arctic, or possibly the Antarctic, I know nothing."
The visitor stared at him in amazement.
"But this is marvellous," he cried. "I thought detectives only did such things in books. But your office boy did not even give you my name."
Tommy sighed deprecatingly.
"Tut, tut, all that was very easy," he said.
The rays of the midnight sun within the Arctic Circle have a peculiar action upon the skin. The actinic rays have certain properties. I'm writing a little monograph on the subject shortly, but all this is wide of the point. What is it that has brought you to me in such distress of mind?
To begin with, Mr. Blunt, my name is Gabriel Stevanson.
Ah, of course, said Tommy, the well-known explorer. You have recently returned from the region of the North Pole, I believe.
I landed in England 3 days ago. A friend who was cruising in northern waters brought me back on his yacht. Otherwise I should not have got back for another fortnight. Now, I must tell you, Mr. Blunt, that before I started on this last expedition 2 years ago, I had the great good fortune to become engaged to Mrs. Morris Lee Gordon.
Tommy interrupted. Mrs. Lee Gordon was, before her marriage,
the Honourable Hermione Crane, second daughter of Lord Lanchester. Reeled off Tuppence glibly.
Tommy threw her a glance of admiration.
Her first husband was killed in the war, added Tuppence.
Gabriel Stevanson nodded.
That is quite correct. As I was saying, Hermione and I became engaged. I offered, of course, to give up this expedition, but she wouldn't hear of such a thing, bless her. She is the right kind of woman for an explorer's wife. Well, my first thought on landing was to see Hermione. I sent a telegram from Southampton and rushed up to town by the first train. I knew that she was living for the time being with an aunt of hers, Lady Susan Clonray, in Pont Street, and I went straight there. To my great disappointment, I found that Hermie was away visiting some friends in Northumberland. Lady Susan was quite nice about it after getting over her first surprise at seeing me. As I told you, I wasn't expected for another fortnight. She said Hermie would be returning in a few days' time. Then I asked for her address, but the old woman hummed and hawed, said Hermie was staying at one or two different places, and that she wasn't quite sure what order she was taking them in. I may as well tell you, Mr. Blunt, that Lady Susan and I have never got on very well. She's one of those fat women with double chins. I loathe fat women, always have. Fat women and fat dogs are an abomination unto the Lord, and unfortunately they so often go together. It is an idiosyncrasy of mine, I know, but there it is. I never can get on with a fat woman.
Fashion agrees with you, Mr. Stevenson, said Tommy dryly, and everyone has their own pet aversion. That of the late Lord Roberts was cats.
Mind you, I'm not saying that Lady Susan isn't a perfectly charming woman, as she may be, but I've never taken to her. I've always felt deep down that she disapproved of our engagement, and I feel sure that she would influence Hermie against me if that were possible. I'm telling you this for what it's worth. Count it out as prejudice, if you like. Well, to go on with my story, I'm the kind of obstinate brute who likes his own way. I didn't leave Pont Street until I'd got out of her the names and addresses of the people Hermie was likely to be staying with. Then I took the mail train north.
You are, I perceive, a man of action, Mr. Stevenson, said Tommy, smiling.
The thing came upon me like a bombshell, Mr. Blunt. None of these people had seen a sign of Hermie. Of the three houses, only one had been expecting her. Lady Susan must have made a bloomer over the other two, and she had put off her visit there at the last moment by telegram. I returned post-haste to London, of course, and went straight to Lady Susan. I will do her the justice to say that she seemed upset. She admitted that she had no idea where Hermie could be. All the same, she strongly negatived any idea of going to the police. She pointed out that Hermie was not a silly young girl, but an independent woman who had always been in the habit of making her own plans. She was probably carrying out some idea of her own. I thought it quite likely that Hermie didn't want to report all her movements to Lady Susan. But I was still worried. I had that queer feeling one gets when something is wrong. I was just leaving when a telegram was brought to Lady Susan. She read it with an expression of relief and handed it to me. It ran as follows. Changed my plans. Just off to Monte Carlo for a week. Hermie.
Tommy held out his hand.
You've got the telegram with you? No, I haven't, but it was handed in at Malden, Surrey. I noticed that at the time, because it struck me as odd. What should Hermie be doing at Malden? She had no friends there that I ever heard of.
You didn't think of rushing off to Monte Carlo in the same way that you had rushed north?
I thought of it, of course, but I decided against it. You see, Mr. Blunt, whilst Lady Susan seemed quite satisfied by that telegram, I wasn't. It struck me as odd that she should always telegraph, not write. A line or two in her own handwriting would have set all my fears at rest, but anyone can sign a telegram, Hermie. The more I thought it over, the more uneasy I got. In the end, I went down to Malden. That was yesterday afternoon. It's a fair-sized place, good links there and all that, two hotels. I inquired everywhere I could think of, but there wasn't a sign that Hermie had ever been there. Coming back in the train, I read your advertisement, and I thought I'd put it up to you. If Hermie has really gone off to Monte Carlo, I don't want to set the police on her track and make a scandal. But I'm not going to be sent off on a wild goose chase myself. I stay here in London, in case there's been foul play of any kind.
Tommy nodded thoughtfully.
What do you suspect, exactly? I don't know. But I feel there's something wrong.
With a quick movement, Stevenson took a case from his pocket and laid it open before them.
That is Hermione, he said. I will leave it with you.
The photograph represented a tall, willowy woman, no longer in her first youth, but with a charming, frank smile and lovely eyes.
"Now, Mr. Stevanson," said Tommy, "there's nothing you have omitted to tell me."
"Nothing whatever."
"No detail, however small?"
"I don't think so."
Tommy sighed. "That makes the task harder," he observed. "You must often have noticed, Mr. Stevanson, in reading of crime, how one small detail is all the great detective needs to set him on the track. I may say that this case presents some unusual features."
"I have, I think, partially solved it already, but time will show."
He picked up a violin which lay on the table and drew the bow once or twice across the strings. Tuppence ground her teeth, and even the explorer blenched. The performer laid the instrument down again.
"A few chords from Moskovsky," he murmured.
"Leave me your address, Mr. Stevanson, and I will report progress to you." As the visitor left the office, Tuppence grabbed the violin and, putting it in the cupboard, turned the key in the lock. "If you must be Sherlock Holmes," she observed, "I'll get you a nice little syringe and a bottle labelled cocaine, but for God's sake, leave that violin alone. If that nice explorer man hadn't been as simple as a child, he'd have seen through you. Are you going on with the Sherlock Holmes touch?"
"I flatter myself that I've carried it through very well so far," said Tommy, with some complacence.
"The deductions were good, weren't they? I had to risk the taxi. After all, it's the only sensible way of getting to this place."
"It's lucky I just read the bit about his engagement in this morning's Daily Mirror," remarked Tuppence.
"Yes, that looked well for the efficiency of Blunt's brilliant detectives. This is decidedly a Sherlock Holmes case. Even you cannot have failed to notice the similarity between it and the disappearance of Lady Frances Carfax."
"Do you expect to find Mrs. Lee Gordon's body in a coffin?"
"Logically, history should repeat itself. Actually, well, what do you think?"
"Well," said Tuppence, "the most obvious explanation seems to be that for some reason or other, Hermie, as he calls her, is afraid to meet her fiancé, and that Lady Susan is backing her up. In fact, to put it bluntly, she's come a cropper of some kind, and has got the wind up about it."
"That occurred to me also," said Tommy. "But I thought we'd better make pretty certain before suggesting that explanation to a man like Stevanson. What about a run down to Malden, old thing? And it would do no harm to take some golf clubs with us."
Tuppence agreeing, the International Detective Agency was left in the charge of Albert.
Malden, though a well-known residential place, did not cover a large area. Tommy and Tuppence, making every possible inquiry that ingenuity could suggest, nevertheless drew a complete blank. It was as they were returning to London that a brilliant idea occurred to Tuppence.
"Tommy, why did they put Malden, Surrey, on the telegram?"
"Because Malden is in Surrey, idiot."
"Idiot yourself. I don't mean that. If you get a telegram from Hastings, say, or Torquay, they don't put the county after it. But from Richmond, they do put Richmond, Surrey. That's because there are two Richmonds."
Tommy, who was driving, slowed up.
"Tuppence," he said affectionately, "your idea is not so dusty. Let us make inquiries at yonder post office."
They drew up before a small building in the middle of a village street. A very few minutes sufficed to elicit the information that there were two Maldens, Malden, Surrey, and Malden, Sussex, the latter a tiny hamlet, but possessed of a telegraph office.
"That's it," said Tuppence excitedly. "Stevanson knew Malden was in Surrey, so he hardly looked at the word beginning with S after Malden."
"Tomorrow," said Tommy, "we'll have a look at Malden, Sussex." Malden, Sussex was a very different proposition to its Surrey namesake. It was 4 miles from a railway station, possessed two public houses, two small shops, a post and telegraph office combined with a sweet and picture postcard business, and about 7 small cottages. Tuppence took on the shops, whilst Tommy betook himself to the Cock and Sparrow. They met 30 minutes later.
"Well?" said Tuppence.
"Quite good beer," said Tommy, "but no information."
"You'd better try the King's Head," said Tuppence. "I'm going back to the post office. There's a sour old woman there, but I heard them yell to her that dinner was ready."
She returned to the place and began examining postcards. A fresh-faced girl, still munching, came out of the back room.
"I'd like these, please," said Tuppence, "and do you mind waiting whilst I just look over these comic ones?"
She sorted through a packet, talking as she did so. I'm ever so disappointed you couldn't tell me my sister's address. She's staying near here, and I've lost her letter. Lee Gordon, her name is.
The girl shook her head. Well, I don't remember it. And we don't get many letters through here either. So I probably should if I'd seen it on a letter. Apart from the Grange, there isn't many big houses round about.
What is the Grange? Asked Tuppence. Who does it belong to?
Dr. Arriston has it. It's turned into a nursing home now. Nerve cases mostly, I believe. Ladies that come down for rescuers and all that sort of thing. Well, it's quiet enough down here. Heaven knows, she giggled.
Tuppence hastily selected a few cards and paid for them.
That's Dr. Arriston's car coming along now, exclaimed the girl.
Tuppence hurried to the shop door. A small two-seater was passing. At the wheel was a tall, dark man with a neat black beard and a powerful, unpleasant face. The car went straight on down the street. Tuppence saw Tommy crossing the road towards her.
Tommy, I believe I've got it. Dr. Horriston's nursing home.
I heard about it at the King's Head, and I thought there might be something in it. But if she's had a nervous breakdown or anything of that sort, her aunt and her friends would know about it, surely.
Yes, I didn't mean that. Tommy, did you see that man in the two-seater?
Unpleasant-looking brute, yes.
That was Dr. Horriston.
Tommy whistled.
Shifty-looking beggar. What do you say about it, Tuppence? Shall we go and have a look at the Grange?
They found the place at last. A big rambling house, surrounded by deserted grounds with a swift mill stream running behind the house.
Dismal sort of abode, said Tommy.
Gives me the creeps.
Tuppence, you know, I've a feeling this is going to turn out a far more serious matter than we thought at first.
Oh, don't. If only we're in time. That woman's in some awful danger. I feel it in my bones.
Don't let your imagination run away with you.
I can't help it. I mistrust that man.
What shall we do?
I think it would be a good plan if I went and rang the bell alone first and asked boldly for Mrs. Lee Gordon just to see what answer I get, because after all, it may be perfectly fair and above board.
Tuppence carried out her plan. The door was opened almost immediately by a manservant with an impassive face.
I want to see Mrs. Lee Gordon, if she's well enough to see me.
She fancied that there was a momentary flicker of the man's eyelashes, but he answered readily enough.
There is no one of that name here, madam.
Oh, surely. This is Dr. Horriston's place. The Grange, is it not?
Yes, madam. But there is nobody of the name of Mrs. Lee Gordon here.
Baffled, Tuppence was forced to withdraw and hold a further consultation with Tommy outside the gate.
Perhaps he was speaking the truth. After all, we don't know.
He wasn't. He was lying, I'm sure of it.
Wait until the doctor comes back, said Tommy. Then I'll pass myself off as a journalist, anxious to discuss his new system of rescue with him.
That will give me a chance of getting inside and studying the geography of the place. The doctor returned about half an hour later. Tommy gave him about 5 minutes, then he, in turn, marched up to the front door. But he, too, returned baffled.
The doctor was engaged and couldn't be disturbed, and he never sees journalists.
Tuppence, you're right. There's something fishy about this place.
It's ideally situated, miles from anywhere. Any mortal thing could go on here, and no one would ever know.
Come on, said Tuppence with determination. What are you going to do? I'm going to climb over the wall and see if I can't get up to the house quietly without being seen.
Right, I'm with you.
The garden was somewhat overgrown and afforded a multitude of cover. Tommy and Tuppence managed to reach the back of the house unobserved. Here, there was a wide terrace with some crumbling steps leading down from it. In the middle, some French windows opened onto the terrace, but they dared not step out into the open, and the windows where they were crouching were too high for them to be able to look in. It did not seem as though their reconnaissance would be much use, when suddenly Tuppence tightened her grasp of Tommy's arm.
Someone was speaking in the room close to them. The window was open, and the fragment of conversation came clearly to their ears.
Come in and shut the door, said a man's voice irritably. A lady came about an hour ago, you said, and asked for Mrs. Lee Gordon.
Tuppence recognized the answering voice as that of the impassive manservant.
Yes, sir.
You said she wasn't here, of course.
Of course, sir.
And now this journalist fellow, fumed the other.
He came suddenly to the window, throwing up the sash, and the two outside, peering through a screen of bushes, recognized Dr. Horriston.
"'It's the woman I mind most about,' continued the doctor. "'What did she look like?'
"'Young, good-looking, and very smartly dressed, sir.' Tommy nudged Tuppence in the ribs.
"'Exactly,' said the doctor between his teeth. "'As I feared. Some friend of the Lee Gordon woman's. It's getting very difficult. I shall have to take steps.'
He left the sentence unfinished. Tommy and Tuppence heard the door close. There was silence. Gingerly, Tommy led the retreat. When they had reached a little clearing not far away, but out of earshot from the house, he spoke.
"Tuppence, old thing, this is getting serious. They mean mischief. I think we ought to get back to town at once and see Stevanson."
To his surprise, Tuppence shook her head.
"We must stay down here. Didn't you hear him say he was going to take steps? That might mean anything.
But the worst of it is, we've hardly got a case to go to the police on.
Listen, Tommy, why not ring up Stevanson from the village? I'll stay around here."
"Perhaps that is the best plan," agreed her husband.
"But I say, Tuppence."
"Well, take care of yourself, won't you?"
"Well, of course I shall, you silly old thing. Cut along."
It was some 2 hours later that Tommy returned. He found Tuppence awaiting him near the gate.
"Well?"
"I couldn't get on to Stevanson. Then I tried Lady Susan. She was out too. Then I thought of ringing up old Brady. I asked him to look up Horriston in the medical directory, or whatever the thing calls itself."
"Well, what did Dr. Brady say?"
"Oh, he knew the name at once. Horriston was once a bona fide doctor, but he came a cropper of some kind. Brady called him a most unscrupulous quack and said he personally wouldn't be surprised at anything. The question is, what are we to do now?"
"We must stay here," said Tuppence instantly. "I've a feeling they mean something to happen tonight. By the way, a gardener has been clipping ivy round the house. Tommy, I saw where he put the ladder."
"Good for you, Tuppence," said her husband appreciatively. "Then tonight,
as soon as it's dark,
we shall see
what we shall see."
Tommy took his turn at watching the house, whilst Tuppence went to the village and had some food. Then she returned, and they took up the vigil together. At 9 o'clock, they decided that it was dark enough to commence operations. They were now able to circle round the house in perfect freedom. Suddenly, Tuppence clutched Tommy by the arm.
"Listen."
The sound she had heard came again, borne faintly on the night air. It was the moan of a woman in pain. Tuppence pointed upward to a window on the first floor.
"It came from that room," she whispered.
Again that low moan rent the stillness of the night. The two listeners decided to put their original plan into action. Tuppence led the way to where she had seen the gardener put the ladder. Between them they carried it to the side of the house from which they had heard the moaning. All the blinds of the ground floor rooms were drawn, but this particular window upstairs was unshuttered. Tommy put the ladder as noiselessly as possible against the side of the house.
"I'll go up," whispered Tuppence. "You stay below. I don't mind climbing ladders, and you can steady it better than I could. And in case the doctor should come round the corner, you'd be able to deal with him, and I shouldn't."
Nimbly, Tuppence swarmed up the ladder and raised her head cautiously to look in at the window. Then she ducked it swiftly, but after a minute or two brought it very slowly up again. She stayed there for about 5 minutes, then she descended again.
"It's her," she said breathlessly and ungrammatically, "but oh, Tommy, it's horrible. She's lying there in bed moaning and turning to and fro, and just as I got there, a woman dressed as a nurse came in. She bent over her and injected something in her arm, and then went away again. What shall we do?"
"Is she conscious?"
"I think so. I'm almost sure she is. I fancy she may be strapped to the bed. I'm going up again, and if I can, I'm going to get into that room. I say, Tuppence, if I'm in any sort of danger, I'll yell for you. So long."
Avoiding further argument, Tuppence hurried up the ladder again. Tommy saw her try the window, then noiselessly push up the sash. Another second, and she had disappeared inside. And now an agonizing time came for Tommy. He could hear nothing at first. Tuppence and Mrs. Lee Gordon must be talking in whispers, if they were talking at all. Presently, he did hear a low murmur of voices and drew a breath of relief, but suddenly the voices stopped. Dead silence. Tommy strained his ears. Nothing. What could they be doing? Suddenly, a hand fell on his shoulder.
Come on, said Tuppence's voice out of the darkness. Tuppence, how did you get here? Through the front door. Let's get out of this. Get out of this? That's what I said. But Mrs. Lee Gordon?
In a tone of indescribable bitterness, Tuppence replied,
Getting thin.
Tommy looked at her, suspecting irony.
What do you mean?
What I say.
Getting thin. Slinkiness. Reduction of weight. Didn't you hear Stefanson say he hated fat women? In the 2 years he's been away, his Hermie has put on weight. Got a panic when she knew he was coming back and rushed off to do this new treatment of Dr. Horriston's. It's injections of some sort, and he makes a deadly secret of it and charges through the nose. I dare say he is a quack, but he's a damned successful one. Stefanson comes home a fortnight too soon when she's only beginning the treatment. Lady Susan has been sworn to secrecy and plays up, and we come down here and make blithering idiots of ourselves.
Tommy drew a deep breath. I believe, Watson, he said with dignity, that there is a very good concert at the Queen's Hall tomorrow. We shall be in plenty of time for it, and you will oblige me by not placing this case upon your records. It has absolutely no distinctive features. Chapter 8 Blind Man's Buff. Right, said Tommy, and replaced the receiver on its hook. Then he turned to Tuppence. That was the chief. Seems to have got the wind up about us. It appears that the parties we're after have got wise to the fact that I'm not the genuine Mr. Theodore Blunt. We're to expect excitements at any minute. The chief begs you as a favour to go home and stay at home, and not mix yourself up in it any more. Apparently the hornet's nest we've stirred up is bigger than anyone imagined. Well, all that about my going home is nonsense, said Tuppence decidedly. Who's going to look after you if I go home? Besides, I like excitement. Business hasn't been very brisk just lately. Well, one can't have murders and robberies every day, said Tommy. Be reasonable. Now, my idea is this. When business is slack, we ought to do a certain amount of home exercises every day. Lie on our backs and wave our feet in the air, that sort of thing. Don't be so literal in your interpretation. When I say exercises, I mean exercises in the detective art. Reproductions of the great masters. For instance, from the drawer beside him, Tommy took out a formidable dark green eyeshade, covering both eyes. This he adjusted with some care. Then he drew a watch from his pocket. I broke the glass this morning, he remarked. That paved the way for its being the crystalless watch, which my sensitive fingers touch so lightly. Be careful, said Tuppence. You nearly had the shorthand off then. Give me your hand, said Tommy. He held it. One finger, feeling for the pulse. Ah, the keyboard of silence. This woman has not got heart disease. I suppose, said Tuppence, that you are Thornley Coulton. Just so, said Tommy. The blind problemist. And you're thingamabob, the black-haired, apple-cheeked secretary. The bundle of baby clothes picked up on the banks of the river, finished Tuppence. And Albert is the fee, alias Shrimp. We must teach him to say G, said Tuppence. And his voice isn't shrill, it's dreadfully hoarse. Against the wall by the door, said Tommy, you perceive the slim hollow cane, which held in my sensitive hands tells me so much. He rose and cannoned into a chair. Damn, said Tommy. I forgot that chair was there. Must be beastly to be blind, said Tuppence with feeling. Rather, agreed Tommy heartily. I'm sorrier for all those poor devils who lost their eyesight in the war than for anyone else. But they say that when you live in the dark, you really do develop special senses. That's what I want to try and see if one couldn't do. It'd be jolly handy to train oneself to be some good in the dark. Now, Tuppence, be a good Sydney Thames. How many steps to that cane? Tuppence made a desperate guess. 3 straight, 5 left, she hazarded. Tommy paced it uncertainly, Tuppence interrupting with a cry of warning as she realized that the 4th step left would take him slap against the wall. There's a lot in this, said Tuppence. You've no idea how difficult it is to judge how many steps are needed. It's jolly interesting, said Tommy. Call Albert in. I'm going to shake hands with you both and see if I know which is which. All right, said Tuppence. "But Albert must wash his hands first. They're sure to be sticky from those beastly acid drops he's always eating." Albert, introduced to the game, was full of interest. Tommy, the handshakes completed, smiled complacently. "The keyboard of silence cannot lie," he murmured. "The first was Albert, the second you, Tuppence." "Wrong," shrieked Tuppence. "Keyboard of silence, indeed. You went by my dress ring, and I put that on Albert's finger." Various other experiments were carried out, with indifferent success. "But it's coming," declared Tommy. "One can't expect to be infallible straight away. I tell you what, it's just lunchtime. You and I will go to the Blitz, Tuppence. Blind man and his keeper. Some jolly useful tips to be picked up there." "I say, Tommy, we shall get into trouble." "No, we shan't. I shall behave quite like the little gentleman. But I bet you that by the end of luncheon, I shall be startling you." All protests being thus overborne, a quarter of an hour later saw Tommy and Tuppence comfortably ensconced at a corner table in the gold room of the Blitz. Tommy ran his fingers lightly over the menu. "Pilaf to homar and grilled chicken for me," he murmured. Tuppence also made her selection, and the waiter moved away. "So far so good," said Tommy. "Now for a more ambitious venture. What beautiful legs that girl in the short skirt has, the one who's just come in. How is that done, Thorn?" "Beautiful legs impart a particular vibration to the floor which is received by my hollow cane. Or, to be honest, in a big restaurant, there is nearly always a girl with beautiful legs standing in the doorway looking for her friends, and with short skirts going about, she'd be sure to take advantage of them." The meal proceeded. "The man two tables from us is a very wealthy profiteer, I fancy," said Tommy carelessly. "Pretty good," said Tuppence appreciatively. "I don't follow that one." "I shan't tell you how it's done every time. It spoils my show. The head waiter is serving champagne three tables off to the right. A stout woman in black is about to pass our table." "Tommy, how can you—" "Aha, you're beginning to see what I can do. That's a nice girl in brown just getting up at the table behind you."
"Snoo," said Tuppence.
"It's a young man in grey."
"Oh," said Tommy, momentarily disconcerted. And at that moment, two men who had been sitting at a table not far away and who had been watching the young pair with keen interest, got up and came across to the corner table.
"Excuse me," said the elder of the two, a tall, well-dressed man with an eyeglass and a small grey moustache, "but you have been pointed out to me as Mr. Theodore Blunt. May I ask if that is so?"
Tommy hesitated a minute, feeling somewhat at a disadvantage. Then he bowed his head.
"That is so. I am Mr. Blunt." "What an unexpected piece of good fortune, Mr. Blunt. I was going to call at your offices after lunch. I am in trouble, very grave trouble. Excuse me, you have had some accident to your eyes?"
"My dear sir," said Tommy in a melancholy voice, "I'm blind, completely blind."
"What?"
"You're astonished. But surely you have heard of blind detectives?"
"In fiction, never in real life. And I have certainly never heard that you were blind."
"Many people are not aware of the fact," murmured Tommy. "I'm wearing an eyeshade today to save my eyeballs from glare, but without it, quite a host of people have never suspected my infirmity, if you call it that. You see, my eyes cannot mislead me. But enough of all this. Shall we go at once to my office, or will you give me the facts of the case here? The latter would be best, I think." A waiter brought up two extra chairs, and the two men sat down. The second man, who had not yet spoken, was shorter, sturdy in build, and very dark.
"It is a matter of great delicacy,"
said the older man, dropping his voice confidentially. He looked uncertainly at Tuppence. Mr. Blunt seemed to feel the glance.
"Let me introduce my confidential secretary," he said. "Miss Ganges. Found on the banks of the Indian River, a mere bundle of baby clothes. Very sad history. Miss Ganges is my eyes. She accompanies me everywhere."
The stranger acknowledged the introduction with a bow.
"Then I can speak out. Mr. Blunt, My daughter, a girl of 16, has been abducted under somewhat peculiar circumstances. I discovered this half an hour ago. The circumstances of the case were such that I dared not call in the police. Instead, I rang up your office. They told me you were out to lunch and would be back by 2:30. I came in here with my friend Captain Harker. The short man jerked his head and muttered something. By the greatest good fortune, you happen to be lunching here also. We must lose no time. You must return with me to my house immediately. Tommy demurred cautiously. I can be with you in 30 minutes. I must return to my office first. Captain Harker, turning to glance at Tuppence, may have been surprised to see a half-smile lurking for a moment at the corners of her mouth. No, no, that will not do. You must return with me. The grey-haired man took a card from his pocket and handed it across the table. That is my name. Tommy fingered it. My fingers are hardly sensitive enough for that, he said with a smile, and handed it to Tuppence, who read out in a low voice, The Duke of Blairgowrie. She looked with great interest at their client. The Duke of Blairgowrie was well known to be a most haughty and inaccessible nobleman, who had married as a wife the daughter of a Chicago pork butcher, many years younger than himself, and of a lively temperament that augured ill for their future together. There had been rumours of disaccord lately. "You will come at once, Mr. Blunt?" said the Duke, with a tinge of acerbity in his manner. Tommy yielded to the inevitable. "Miss Ganges and I will come with you," he said quietly. "You will excuse my just stopping to drink a large cup of black coffee. They will serve it immediately. I'm subject to very distressing headaches, the result of my eye trouble, and the coffee steadies my nerves." He called a waiter and gave the order. Then he spoke to Tuppence. Miss Ganges, I'm lunching here tomorrow with the French Prefect of Police. Just note down the luncheon and give it to the head waiter with instructions to reserve me my usual table. I'm assisting the French police in an important case. The fee, he paused, is considerable. Are you ready, Miss Ganges?
Quite ready, said Tuppence,
her stylo poised. We will start with that special salad of shrimps that they have here, then to follow, yes, omelette blitz, and perhaps a couple of tournedos de l'étranger. He paused and murmured apologetically. You will forgive me, I hope. Ah, yes, souffle en surprise. That will conclude the repast. A most interesting man, the French prefect. You know him, perhaps? The other replied in the negative, as Tuppence rose and went to speak to the head waiter. Presently she returned, just as the coffee was brought. Tommy drank a large cup of it, sipping it slowly, then rose. Am I cane, Miss Ganges? Thank you. Directions, please? It was a moment of agony for Tuppence.
One right, 18 straight. About the 5th step, there is a waiter serving the table on your left.
Swinging his cane jauntily, Tommy set out. Tuppence kept close behind him and endeavoured unobtrusively to steer him. All went well until they were just passing out through the doorway. A man entered rather hurriedly, and before Tuppence could warn the blind Mr. Blunt, he had barged right into the newcomer. Explanations and apologies ensued. At the door of the Blitz, a smart landaulette was waiting. The Duke himself aided Mr. Blunt to get in.
"Are your car here, Harker?"
he asked over his shoulder. "Yes, just round the corner.
Take Miss Ganges in it, will you?"
Before another word could be said, he had jumped in beside Tommy, and the car rolled smoothly away.
"A very delicate matter," murmured the Duke. "I can soon acquaint you with all the details."
Tommy raised his hand to his head. "I can remove my eyeshade now," he observed pleasantly. "It was only the glare of artificial light in the restaurant necessitated its use." But his arm was jerked down sharply. At the same time, he felt something hard and round being poked between his ribs.
"No, my dear Mr. Blunt," said the Duke's voice,
but a voice that seemed suddenly different.
"You will not remove that eyeshade. You will sit perfectly still and not move in any way, you understand?
I don't want this pistol of mine to go off.
You see, I happen not to be the Duke of Blairgowrie at all. I borrowed his name for the occasion, knowing that you would not refuse to accompany such a celebrated client. I am something much more prosaic.
A ham merchant who has lost his wife. He felt the start the other gave. Aha, that tells you something, he laughed. My dear young man, you've been incredibly foolish. I'm very much afraid that your activities will be curtailed in future. He spoke the last words with a sinister relish. Tommy sat motionless. He did not reply to the other's taunts. Presently, the car slackened its pace and drew up. Just a minute, said the pseudo-duke. He twisted a handkerchief deftly into Tommy's mouth and drew up his scarf over it. In case you should be foolish enough to think of calling for help, he explained suavely. The door of the car opened, and the chauffeur stood ready. He and his master took Tommy between them and propelled him rapidly up some steps and in at the door of a house. The door closed behind them. There was a rich oriental smell in the air. Tommy's feet sank deep into velvet pile. He was propelled in the same fashion up a flight of stairs and into a room which he judged to be at the back of the house. Here the two men bound his hands together. The chauffeur went out again, and the other removed the gag. You may speak freely now, he announced pleasantly. What have you to say for yourself, young man? Tommy cleared his throat and eased the aching corners of his mouth. I hope you haven't lost my hollow cane, he said mildly. It cost me a lot to have that made. You have nerve, said the other, after a minute's pause. Or else you are just a fool. Don't you understand that I've got you? Got you in the hollow of my hand? That you're absolutely in my power? That no one who knows you is ever likely to see you again? Can't you cut out the melodrama? Asked Tommy plaintively. Have I got to say, you villain, I'll foil you yet? That sort of thing is so very much out of date. What about the girl? Said the other, watching him. Doesn't that move you? Putting two and two together during my enforced silence just now, said Tommy, I've come to the inevitable conclusion that that chatty lad Harker is another of the doers of desperate deeds, and that therefore my unfortunate secretary will shortly join this little tea party. Right, as to one point, but wrong on the other. Mrs. Beresford, you see, I know all about you. Mrs. Beresford will not be brought here. That is a little precaution I took. It occurred to me that just probably your friends in high places might be keeping you shadowed. In that case, by dividing the pursuit, you could not both be trailed. I should still keep one in my hands. I am waiting now, he broke off as the door opened. The chauffeur spoke. We've not been followed, sir. It's all clear. Good. You can go, Gregory. The door closed again. So far, so good, said the Duke. And now, what are we to do with you, Mr. Beresford Blunt? I wish you'd take this confounded eyeshade off me, said Tommy. I think not. With it on, you are truly blind. Without it, you would see as well as I do. And that would not suit my little plan, for I have a plan. You are fond of sensational fiction, Mr. Blunt. This little game that you and your wife were playing today proves that. Now I, too, have arranged a little game, something rather ingenious, as I am sure you will admit when I explain it to you. You see, this floor on which you are standing is made of metal, and here and there on its surface are little projections. I touch a switch, so. A sharp click sounded. Now the electric current is switched on. To tread on one of those little knobs now means death. You understand? If you could see, but you cannot see. You are in the dark. That is the game. Blind man's buff with death. If you can reach the door in safety, freedom. But I think that long before you reach it, you will have trodden on one of those danger spots, and that will be very amusing for me. He came forward and unbound Tommy's hands. Then he handed him his cane. With a little ironical bow. The blind problemist. Let us see if he will solve this problem. I shall stand here with my pistol ready. If you raise your hands to your head to remove that eyeshade, I shoot. Is that clear? Perfectly clear, said Tommy. He was rather pale, but determined. I haven't a dog's chance, I suppose. Oh, that. The other shrugged his shoulders. Damned ingenious devil, aren't you? Said Tommy. But you've forgotten one thing.
May I light a cigarette, by the way? My poor little heart's going pit-a-pat. You may light a cigarette, but no tricks. I'm watching you, remember, with the pistol ready.
I'm not a performing dog, said Tommy. I don't do tricks. He extracted a cigarette from his case, then felt for a match.
It's all right. I'm not feeling for a revolver. But you know well enough that I'm not armed. All the same, as I said before, you've forgotten one thing.
What is that? Tommy took a match from the box and held it ready to strike.
I'm blind, and you can see. That's admitted. The advantage is with you, but supposing we were both in the dark.
Huh?
Where's your advantage then?
He struck the match.
Thinking of shooting at the switch of the lights? Plunging the room into darkness? It can't be done.
Just so, said Tommy. I can't give you darkness, but extremes meet, you know.
What about light?
As he spoke, he touched the match to something he held in his hand and threw it down upon the table. A blinding glare filled the room. Just for a minute, blinded by the intense white light, the Duke blinked and fell back, his pistol hand lowered. He opened his eyes again to feel something sharp pricking his breast.
Drop that pistol, ordered Tommy. Drop it quick. I agree with you that a hollow cane is a pretty rotten affair, so I didn't get one. A good sword stick is a very useful weapon, though. Don't you think so? Almost as useful as magnesium wire. Drop that pistol.
Obedient to the necessity of that sharp point, the man dropped it. Then, with a laugh, he sprang back.
But I still have the advantage, he mocked, for I can see, and you cannot.
That's where you're wrong, said Tommy. I can see perfectly. The eyeshades are fake. I was going to put one over on Tuppence. Make one or two bloomers to begin with, and then put in some perfectly marvellous stuff towards the end of lunch. Why, bless you, I could have walked to the door and avoided all the knobs with perfect ease, but I didn't trust you to play a sporting game. You'd never have let me get out of this alive.
Careful now.
For with his face distorted with rage, the Duke sprang forward, forgetting in his fury to look where he put his feet. There was a sudden blue crackle of flame, and he swayed for a minute, then fell like a log. A faint odour of singed flesh filled the room, mingling with a stronger smell of ozone.
Phew, said Tommy.
He wiped his face. Then, moving gingerly, and with every precaution, he reached the wall and touched the switch he had seen the other manipulate. He crossed the room to the door, opened it carefully, and looked out. There was no one about. He went down the stairs and out through the front door. Safe in the street, he looked up at the house with a shudder, noting the number. Then he hurried to the nearest telephone box. There was a moment of agonizing anxiety, and then a well-known voice spoke.
Tuppence, thank goodness. Yes, I'm all right. I got all your points. The fee, shrimp, come to the Blitz, and follow the two strangers. Albert got there in time, and when we went off in separate cars, followed me in a taxi, saw where they took me, and rang up the police.
Albert's a good lad, said Tommy. Chivalrous. I was pretty sure he'd choose to follow you, but I've been worried all the same.
I've got lots to tell you. I'm coming straight back now, and the first thing I shall do when I get back is to write a thumping big check for St. Dunstan's.
Lord, it must be awful not to be able to see.